In our review, I just wanted to look at Eleazar praying for Abraham's welfare and then going to Mesopotamia. The text that we looked at last week, it just totally ignores the distance and the amount of time that it's traveling. It was over 400 miles from Beersheba to go up into Syria. And it was going to take a month or more on camels. He took 10 camels, which was just a segment of Abraham's wealth. He took a whole bunch of monetary type things, gold and silver, to pay for the bride, and he wanted to make a big impression on her family, and it was also going to test her character, and because they were going to need that as well for the entourage for them coming back. And we've seen it in several spots in Scripture. 10 has some significance here in gift giving. The entourage traveled to Aram Naharim, and Aram is still the ancient Hebrew name for Syria. That's what they call Syria today, Aram. So Eleazar takes these camels, and he goes to a well just outside the city, and we've noticed how important wells are in these arid climates. They're extremely important because they don't have the kind of water that we have here, and we forget that. We have an incredible amount of water. I'm surprised that some of the southwestern states haven't tried to steal it from us yet. Build a big pipe down to Arizona or Southern California because they have just an incredibly difficult time with water. I know that there's been some discussions of that, and they've stopped short of ever trying to do something. But when Eleazar went to the well, he knew that people congregated there. It was the evening, and he knew that women traditionally went out for water at that time and place. So it was natural for a stranger to go to the wells. He could replenish his water supplies, and he could make useful contacts and find out what was going on in the city. That was the congregation place. The shepherds went there. The townsfolk went there. And we saw that Jacob went there, too, when he arrived in Haran. Moses did the same thing when he fled to Midian. It's just an incredibly important commodity, and people congregate around it because of the necessity and the low availability of it in these Arab climates. And we remember back chapter 21 where Abimelech's men were stealing the well that Abraham had, and Abimelech didn't even know about it. So it is a precious commodity, a real precious commodity. Eleazar is praying that Isaac's future bride will give him and his camels water to drink. It's like he sets up this criteria. He says, Lord, let me see a sign here that it will be the woman that comes to the well will give me water and the camels water. And he asked that this will be done for Abraham's sake, not his sake. Not even the lady's sake or Isaiah. I'm just fixated on Isaiah. I've been reading in Isaiah this week. Yitzhak's sake, Isaac's sake. This guy was really a loyal servant. It's a good example for us, for our work and our careers. When you go to work for somebody, work for them in earnest. And continue to work for them earnest, even if they're difficult. Act as if you are working towards the Lord. You're working for the Lord. We've all had difficult employment situations where you just can't stand your boss and they're really hard to deal with. You work in that until the appropriate time to leave. But while you're there working, you made an obligation. If you can't stand the person you're working for, work according to the Lord, like Ephesians 6:5-6 says. Anyway, to water 10 camels was an incredible amount of work, and they guzzle about 25 gallons each if they are fully depleted, and that's going to be somewhere around 250 gallons if they all needed to be watered. He had the camels kneel down in preparation for receiving the water. And we can see the divine providence that's happening here. Because remember back when Abraham gave him the oath and sent him off, it was said that God's angels are going to follow him. And there will be a wife. Abraham just dismissed the whole idea of Eliezer saying that, well, what if she doesn't want to come? What if she's not there? You know, and he was just raising the possibility that this wasn't going to take place. But in reality, the divine providence was that Isaac was going to have a bride. It was going to come from the family of Nahor back in Mesopotamia. And it wasn't chance. It was not chance. And the criteria that Eliezer establishes are not personal beauty, attractiveness, or physical appearance. The ideal wife was going to be hospitable to strangers, kind to animals, and willing to give of herself to others. Now, the difficulty in this, you can see, is going to be giving these camels water. It's just an incredible amount of water. And if it's 250 gallons, she's going to be really industrious to go about doing this. And he didn't ask her to do this. He's not saying, I want you to do this. But the prayer is answered almost immediately from the time he got to the well. He knew that he was in the region of Nahor's family, and the chronology, if you will, the genealogy was given to us in the 22nd chapter. But the providential nature of this meeting is just phenomenal. It was not a chance encounter. God has got plans for us too, if we just look for them. And don't turn away from Him. Don't deny the providence. Don't deny His ability to change the paths of our life, to put us in places where He wants us to be. Let Him have His way, and He will guide us. The woman that comes to the well was well endowed with beauty. She was chaste. She had a precious, precious virtue. It was unblemished. And when Eliezer saw her, he ran to meet her. I mean, the sense of urgency that he displayed here is incredible. He saw the water bottle that she was carrying, and he asked her if he could get some water to drink. And she responds by going about her business very briskly and conscientiously. She wasn't gossiping. She wasn't wasting any time. No other distractions. She got right to it. And she also asked if she could provide water for his camels. Well, that just had to floor him, because that was what he was telling God. If she will only do that, God, you know, then I'll know she's the one. And she did. She did exactly. Now, she knew how much work was associated with watering 10 camels, 250 gallons, but she got right to the job. And it's interesting, in the Hebrew text here, there's only one verb used in these passages for speaking, but there's 11 different verbs used for the actions that Rebecca went about. I mean, it just shows you she was a woman of action. She wasn't a woman of gossip and idle chatter. She got right to the job. Eliezer just watched in amazement at what was going on. He wanted to make sure that the Lord had led him to the right woman. And she impressed him so much that he starts to bestow gifts on her. He gives her a nose ring, which was, you know, fashionable in that day. And he gave her gold bracelets for her hands. Now, in today's money, this was roughly $14,000 worth of jewelry. Can you imagine $14,000 worth of jewelry? Now, most women like jewelry, but there was also a high volume or high value of trading here with the ability. I mean, the value there, boy, you're looking at this and thinking, you know, if I don't even like this style, I can trade it in and get something else because it's really valuable. Her family was going to appreciate the gifts because they were really going to realize the earnestness with which he was carrying this out. He was serious. He was serious. It was, the whole thing was designed just to move the discussions along quicker. So he offers to move things along by saying, well, whose daughter are you? Tell me. I pray you. And he says, is there room in your father's house for us to lodge in? And she tells him that she's the daughter of Bethuel, who was the son of Milcah, whom she bore unto Nahor. Now, this showed the relationship to Abraham. one of the conditions that Abraham had given him. And then she responds about the question of the lodging. She said, we have both straw and provender, enough room to lodge in. Now, provender and straw was referring to the amount of his retinue, these 10 camels, all these people that were with him. They were going to take them all in. And it was a very, very generous undertaking on her part to be willing to make this provision for her. Eliezer responds immediately by worshiping and thanking God. That's his first move. And it's something for us to see. When something happens in our life, both good and bad, thank God. If it's bad, the first thing we want to do is turn away and say, what is going on? He's got a correction for us. He's trying to teach us something. Don't view the bad things that happen in life as incidental and God's not in control, because he is. He's in control of everything. And you can learn something from the bad experiences. I don't like them either, but I've had more growth in the things that hurt than I did in the things that are fun. A whole lot more growth. Eliezer responds through his prayer, and he's just thanking God, saying, blessed be Jehovah, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his loving kindness towards my master. It's a clear recognition that the Abrahamic covenant is being fulfilled, partially here. And he knows that God's in control, because he says that Jehovah hath led me in the way to the house of my master's brethren. So he recognizes the providence and the angel that brought the proper woman to the well just at the right time with the right qualities for a wife for Isaac. The sign requested had been fulfilled, and the servant recognized God's total providence in this. Look at what Rebecca's characteristics are. They pretty much mirror that in Proverbs 31. She was hardworking, she's efficient, conscientious, friendly, helpful, hospitable to strangers, kind to animals, willing to give of herself to others, chaste, and she had an unblemished character. Doesn't say anything about how beautiful she was. Doesn't say anything about how sexy she was, how cool she was. These are internal characteristics that are important. We have a tendency to look at all the other stuff first. Instead of character and how one conducts themselves, how hard they're willing to work. Because that's what it takes to have a lifelong commitment. Not how cool you look or what school you went to or any of that stuff. But that's all external stuff that we look at. We get it so backwards. We get it so backwards. And, you know, I don't know if the number is still as bad as it was, but the last time I looked, our marriage failure rate in this country was somewhere around 50%. And our system of, we don't even have a system of courting. I'm not sure what we do. How do you describe what we do? We just kind of look for people and hook up with them, and that we'll do that in another lesson. For today, I want to look at the rest of the story of this marriage. It starts with Eliezer meeting the family. Genesis 24, verses 28 to 33. And the damsel ran and told her mother's house according to these words. And Rebekah had a brother, and his name was Laban. And Laban ran out into the man unto the fountain. And it came to pass, when he saw the ring and the bracelets upon his sister's hands, and when he heard the words of Rebekah his sister, saying, thus spake the man unto me, that he came unto the man. And behold, he was standing by the camels at the fountain. And he said, come in, thou blessed of Jehovah. Wherefore standest thou without? For I have prepared the house and room for the camels. And the man came into the house, and he ungirded the camels. And he gave straw and provender for the camels, and water to wash his feet, and the feet of the men that were with him. And there was set food before him to eat. But he said, I will not eat until I have told mine errand. And he said, speak on. Rebecca, again, is showing her sense of urgency because she runs into her mother's house. It's interesting the way they characterize it as her mother's house, because she was going to go talk to her mother first. The first thing she wanted to do was go to her mother and tell her what had been taking place. And when the news got broadcast within the house, her brother, sort of taking charge here, Laban, he wants to find out what's going on. So he comes out, and he's got this sense of urgency too. You know, here's Rebecca providing all this water and talking to Eleazar at the well, and then she comes back in the house with all this gold, $14,000 plus worth of gold. And the text says that Laban spoke to Eleazar and says, "Come in, thou blessed of Jehovah." The first thing he saw was the wealth. That was the first thing that attracted him. Oh, this guy's rich. Come on in here. I want to talk to you. You know, this guy's got lots of money. Then he provides food, water, and food for the camels and so on, and water to wash their feet. Eleazar was given food, but he wouldn't take any of the food until he had cleared the matter of what it was that he came here for. The hospitality was nice. It was acceptable. I mean, I'm sure he really enjoyed it, because we'll see in the next section here that he did. But that wasn't what was on his mind. His mind was focused on his task, and he had to get that done. This seemed to be the right family. Was it the right woman? Seemed to be the right woman. Well, let's see how things play out. Now, the next section is rather lengthy in Scripture, and it's kind of a retelling of the entire story, a summation of the entire story of Abraham sending Eleazar out to Mesopotamia. And he said, "I am Abraham's servant, and Jehovah hath blessed my master greatly, and he has become great. And he hath given him flocks and herds and silver and gold and men servants and maid servants and camels and asses. And Sarah, my master's wife, bare a son to my master when he was old." And she was old. "And unto him hath he given all that he hath. And my master made me swear, saying, thou shalt not take a wife for my son of the daughters of the Canaanites, in whose land I dwell. But thou shalt go unto my father's house and to my kindred and take a wife for my son. And I said unto my master, peradventure the woman will not follow me. And he said unto me, Jehovah, before whom I walk, will send his angel with thee and prosper thy way, and thou shalt take a wife for my son of my kindred and of my father's house. Then shalt thou be clear of my oath when thou comest to my kindred. And if they give her not to thee, thou shalt be clear of my oath. And I came this day unto the fountain and said, O Jehovah, the God of my master Abraham, if now thou do prosper my way which I go, behold, I am standing by the fountain of water, and let it come to pass that the maiden that cometh forth to draw, to whom I shall say, give me, I pray thee, a little water from thy pitcher to drink, and she shall say unto me, both drink thou, and I will also draw for thy camels. Let the same be the woman whom Jehovah hath appointed for my master's son. And before I had done speaking in my heart, behold, Rebekah came forth with her pitcher on her shoulder. And she went down unto the fountain and drew. And I said unto her, let me drink, I pray thee. And she made haste and let down her pitcher from her shoulder and said, drink, and I will give thy camels drink also. So I drank, and she made the camels drink also. And I asked her and said, whose daughter art thou? And she said, the daughter of Bethuel, Nahor's son, whom Milcah bare unto him. And I put the ring upon her nose and the bracelets upon her hands, and I bowed my head and worshipped Jehovah, the blessed Jehovah, the God of my master Abraham, who had led me in the right way to take my master's brother's daughter for his son. And now if ye will deal kindly and truly with my master, tell me. And if not, tell me, that I may turn to the right hand or to the left." Now, this is largely repetitive of what we've seen, but God will do this. When he's writing to us, he will recall things. He will restate things that are important. And this whole story is very important because it's restated here in its entirety in the 24th chapter. He tells the story that God blessed Abraham with wealth, gave him a child when he was 100 years old. Sarah was 90 years old. And Abraham truly has been blessed. It wasn't Ishmael or Eliezer who's going to receive the inheritance. It's Isaac. The text makes it really clear. Isaac receives the inheritance. Before Isaac was born, before Ishmael was born, Abraham is wondering, well, Lord, are you going to provide an offspring for me, or shall I give what I own to Eliezer? Now, Eliezer was his most trusted servant, would be like a CEO, the guy that was running his entire business. And he's thinking, this guy's really trusted. Is this who I'm going to give things to? And it's interesting that Islam claims that Abraham visited Arabia with the inheritor of the covenant, Ishmael. Now, this text obviously refutes that notion altogether. God told Abraham that he was going to bless Ishmael, but the covenant was going to be established with Isaac. The covenant would not go to Ishmael. The Quran states this absolutely in reverse. And remember, the Quran was written like 2,600 years after these events were recorded here. God planned to bring the Messiah through Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and then Judah, one of Jacob's 12 sons. The Quran doesn't specifically state which son of Abraham was supposed to be sacrificed at the Akedah that we looked at a few weeks ago on Mount Moriah. Today, most Muslims, whatever kind they are, the Sunnis or the Shiites, believe it was Ishmael, contrary to what the truth is. But that's what the cults do. They twist things around, and people will not go to the original sources and validate what truth is. They just accept what somebody says. And as we noticed earlier, people forget. They just forget. They don't want to do the work, so they just accept what they hear is truth. The contrast here, the biblical record says it's Isaac that receives this covenant. And the early Muslim commentators knew this. They believed and they stated clearly that the child that was to be sacrificed on Mount Moriah was Isaac. It wasn't Ishmael. There are a lot of additions to the Quran called the Hadith. And the Hadith is obviously incorrect that makes this statement that Ishmael is the child of promise, because he isn't. None of the Jewish sources, the Bible, the Talmud, the Targums, any of them ever mention anything except Isaac. And we have, you know, we can look at the Dead Sea Scrolls that will state these things, because you get almost the whole Old Testament of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And they were written around 100 B.C., approximately. And what we have is the Quran was written around 600 A.D. So the logic there doesn't make any sense. But, you know, when people are spreading untruth, logic and reason don't come into play, because they have something that they want to push. And they push it hard enough that people begin to believe it, because they think, well, that person is so earnest in what they're doing and so fervent, there must be some truth there, which is not the case. Isaac was the covenantal heir, not Eliezer or Ishmael. Now, Eliezer states that he made this oath with Abraham. And it really demonstrates how serious they viewed all these things. It was sort of an honor to bring this to her family, saying, I made an oath, these are the things that happened. And it's honoring on somebody's family. I'm looking for you from this family to come into this family over here, because this is a God-driven concept here. It's divine providence that this should happen. They are rejecting a Canaanite wife, and that explains why Isaac hasn't married yet. What Eliezer does not mention at all in this text is why Abraham left them in the first place. The family is hearing about divine guidance, how Jehovah provided for them, and it's got to have a strong impression on them. They appear to be recognizing that God is instrumental in these activities taking place. And he finishes this discourse with a question, specifically asking her for her hand. You know, there's a technique in sales that you can present a concept to somebody, you can talk to them about its features and its benefits, you got to ask for the sale. You got to point blank ask for, will you buy this today? If not today, if they say, well, I don't know, say, well, then when would you buy it? And get them to tell you why they wouldn't do it. This is what he's doing. He's asking for this. He's asking for her hand here right now. Because he's saying, if not, I'm going to have to leave. I'll go to the right or the left. It's just saying, I'll take a path out of here. He did have the possibility of rejection because he discussed that with Abraham as part of the oath. I think Abraham didn't fully assure him. He only tried that, look, God's involved in this and the angel's going to lead you. God's involved in this and the angel's going to lead you to the right woman and this will happen. And the text moves on to say, then Laban and Bethuel answered and said, The thing proceedeth from Jehovah. We cannot speak unto thee bad or good. Behold, Rebekah is before thee. Take her and go, and let her be thy master's son's wife, as Jehovah hath spoken. And it came to pass that when Abraham's servant heard their words, he bowed himself to the earth unto Jehovah. And the servant brought forth jewels of silver and jewels of gold and raiment and gave them to Rebekah and gave also to her brother and to her mother precious things. And they did eat and drink, he and the men that were with them, and tarried all night. And they rose up in the morning, and he said, send me away unto my master. And her brother and her mother said, let the damsel abide with us a few days, at the least 10. After that she shall go. And he said unto them, hinder me not, seeing Jehovah hath prospered my way. Send me away, that I may go to my master. And he said unto them, hinder me not, seeing Jehovah hath prospered my way. Send me away, that I may go to my master. And they said, we will call the damsel and inquire at her mouth. And they called Rebekah and said unto her, wilt thou go with this man? And she said, I will go. And they sent away Rebekah their sister and her nurse and Abraham's servant his men. And they blessed Rebekah and said unto her, our sister, be thou the mother of thousands of 10,000s, and let thy seed possess the gate of those that hate thee, hate them. So Laban and his father Bethuel both recognize the divine providence in what was taking place here. Because they said this thing, the thing proceeded from Jehovah. And they consented to the marriage. It's sort of typical of the Middle Eastern arrangements that were made like this in ancient times. We see it in Genesis 34 and Judges 21. Eleazar is now getting relieved of any of the concerns that he had before. And he just, the first thing he does is he thanks God. He bows himself to the earth and he thanks God. And then he begins to shower her with gifts, a lot more than before. She gets silver and gold and clothing. And he also gives gifts to her mother and brother Laban. And then they settle down to the meal. So finally, now he's ready to eat with them. So he says, let's settle down to the meal. And they rise early in the morning. Then he says, okay, I want to go back to Abraham and Isaac. And they want to keep her. Some days, or rather 10, yamim o sor. It's a famous Hebrew saying. We'll just stay a while. Basically, stay a while. We just don't want this to end, you know. They weren't trying to hold on to her. They were just trying to enjoy the situation that they've experienced all the more. But Rebekah was ready to go. She wanted to go. So they sent away Rebekah, their sister. Now, Laban is the leading person in this affair, and her nurse. Now, the Hebrew word for the nurse here means meniket. It's the word meniket. It's a wet nurse, like Hatshepsut had. Remember, she was Pharaoh's daughter, and she found the baby Moses and knew that she had to get a wet nurse for her. And coincidentally, it turned out to be Moses' mother. Rebecca, being a virgin, certainly didn't need a wet nurse. But in Mesopotamia, the wet nurse, and I put a few Akkadian terms down there, it just means the person would be attached to that individual that they nursed for a long period of time, even on into adulthood. We know that this nurse was Deborah, and she celebrated in Genesis 35:8, where her death and burial are recorded. She was a valued member of the family. She attended and reared Rebecca from birth. The mother and Laban give her the parting wish that she might be exceedingly fruitful. And they engage in a little hyperbole of thousands and ten thousands and so on. But she will produce nations that are within her. She will have twins, Esau and Jacob, that will struggle within her and produce huge populations of Arabs and Jewish people. And their parting words, while they were hyperbole, were actually factual, because that many people, tens and tens of thousands, came from her. And I'm going to close today with Genesis 24, verses 61 to 62, which is 67, which is the actual marriage that takes place. And Rebecca arose and her damsels, and they rode upon the camels and followed the man. And the servant took Rebecca and went his way. And Isaac came from the way of Beer Lahairoi, for he dwelt in the land of the south. And Isaac went out to meditate in the field at the eventide. And he lifted up his eyes and saw, and behold, there were camels coming. And Rebekah lifted up her eyes, and when she saw Isaac, she alighted from the camel. And she said unto the servant, "What man is this that walketh in the field to meet us?" And the servant said, "It is my master." And she took her veil and covered herself. And the servant told Isaac all the things that he had done. And Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent and took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. And Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. Now remember, they got a journey going back now that's going to take over a month with all of this caravan. And the entourage here was now going to have more people than they started with. It wasn't just Rebecca and her wet nurse. It was other women that came with her, damsels, the text says. The story then switches all the way back to the Negev, or southern part of Canaan there in the desert. And they're near Beer Lahairoi, and the scene now focuses over to Isaac. He was engaging in prayer in the evening, and he saw this caravan approaching in the distance. Now he knew that if Providence was going to bless him and Eleazar was going to be successful, he would have a wife coming, but he didn't know how long it was going to take. When Rebecca noticed him, now this is really cool, she got off her camel and she's asking Eliezer, who was this man? Now, the word, the Hebrew word for alight or to get off the camel is nafal. Nafal, and it means to fall off. It doesn't mean that she casually and graciously got off her camel. She fell off her camel. And it might be love at first sight here. Just amazed at what she was seeing. So she quickly veils her face. And this is a display of modesty in the Mideast. For the Hebrews did not require women to wear veils. It's only in Islam that this has happened. It was not a requirement for the Hebrews or even the other women in the Mesopotamian regions and other cultures. It they just weren't normally veiled. Sarah wasn't veiled. Tamar, that we'll read about later, veiled herself to deceive Judah. But she didn't do it because she was required to do so. There's also some evidence that the veiling of a bride was part of a marriage ceremony. The Akkadian bride on her wedding day is called the Kalu Kutbutu, and it just means veiled bride. There was a Middle Assyrian law that said raising a concubine to the status of wife required her to become veiled in the presence of the court. It was part of a legal proceeding that they did. But again, people were not, or women were not, required to be veiled. It's just an unspoken signal to Isaac that this is your bride. This is your bride. So Eleazar then recounts all the events acquiring Rebekah to Isaac. And it's just followed by a real simple wedding ceremony. He took her into his mother's tent. Now, Sarah had been dead for 3 years. The tent was still up and it was waiting for occupancy. They completed their physical union, and the text says he loved her. Rebekah now becomes the formally instituted matriarch after Sarah of the line of the Jewish people. The providential ability to pass the covenant down has been secured now, and she will have sons as God has promised to pass the covenant down. There are some. What I want you to see here, though, is the components of a biblical marriage. That one, there's a commitment to each other for a lifelong union. It's a commitment. It's not a casual relationship where if I like things, great. If I don't, I'm getting out. It's a commitment that both parties make. And Isaac loved her. Love is a decision that one makes to care for another person. It's not just a deep romantic or a highly sexually charged emotion. Love is what happens after that. Love is that serious commitment. I will care for you. I will love you no matter what. We see that in our wedding vows that we have today. Regardless of what happens, I will love you. It's not that great glow that happens when you're really infatuated with somebody. That's fun too. I like that as well. That's not what God wants, though. That doesn't last. And then they have an adherence to a marriage ceremony regarding the culture that they're in. Here in the United States, we would have rings, and we have vows, we get a license, maybe a blood test. I don't even know if they do that anymore. But we have things that we must do to satisfy the authorities in the government. They did that as well. And finally, there's a sexual union, and the two become one flesh as God has intended. Now, the beauty of this story is how God controls things. He tells us who to look for in a spouse, what those characteristics are, and then he tells us what the bond between a man and a woman should be to have the union that he wants us to have. And it's what he has given us and is what we have to pass on to our children. And we've got to make this known to other people. Like I said earlier, I wish we could do arranged marriages, but no one is going to accept that here. The culture's gone way beyond that. Even to try and suggest that to your children, they'd probably throw rocks at you, at the least. If there's any firearms in the house, you better not say anything, you know. Shall we pray?